escaped from shipwreck and hunger neither found nor deserved mercy at the hands of their implacable pursuers. The sword and the gibbet reduced the dangerous multitude of captives, and the remainder was more usefully employed to restore the sacred edifices which they had attempted to subvert. The pontiff, at the head of the citizens and allies, paid his grateful devotion at the shrines of the apostles, and among the spoils of this naval victory, 13 Arabian bows of pure and massy silver were suspended round the altar of the fishermen of Galilee. The reign of Leo IV was employed in the defense and ornament of the Roman state. The churches were renewed and embellished. Near 4,000 pounds of silver were consecrated to repair the losses of St. Peter, and his sanctuary was decorated with a plate of gold of the weight of 216 pounds, embossed with the portraits of the Pope and Emperor, and encircled with a string of pearls. Yet this vain magnificence reflects less glory on the character of Leo than the paternal care with which he rebuilt the walls of Horta and Ameria, and transported the wandering inhabitants of Ketumkeli to his new foundation of Leopolis, 12 miles from the seashore. By his liberality, a colony of Corsicans, with their wives and children, was planted in the station of Porto, at the mouth of the Tiber. The falling city was restored for their use. The fields and vineyards were divided among the new settlers. Their first efforts were assisted by a gift of horses and cattle, and the hardy exiles, who breathed revenge against the Saracens, swore to live and die under the standard of St. Peter. The nations of the west and north, who visited the threshold of the apostles, had gradually formed the large and populous suburb of the Vatican, and their various habitations were distinguished, in the language of the times, as the schools of the Greeks and Goths, of the Lombards and Saxons. But this venerable spot was still open to sacrilegious insult. The design of enclosing it with walls and towers exhausted all that authority could command or charity would supply, and the pious labor of 4 years was animated in every season and at every hour by the presence of the indefatigable pontiff. The love of fame, a generous but worldly passion, may be detected in the name of the Leonine city, which he bestowed on the Vatican. Yet the pride of the dedication was tempered with Christian penance and humility. The boundary was trod by the bishop and his clergy, barefoot, in sackcloth and ashes. The songs of triumph were modulated to psalms and litanies. The walls were besprinkled with holy water, and the ceremony was concluded with a prayer that, under the guardian care of the apostles and the angelic host, both the old and the new Rome might ever be preserved pure, prosperous, and impregnable. The Emperor Theophilus, son of Michael the Stammerer, was one of the most active and high-spirited princes who reigned at Constantinople during the Middle Age. In offensive or defensive war, he marched in person 5 times against the Saracens. Formidable in his attack, esteemed by the enemy in his losses and defeats. In the last of these expeditions, he penetrated into Syria and besieged the obscure town of Sosopetra, the casual birthplace of the Caliph Mutasim, whose father Harun was attended in peace or war by the most favored of his wives and concubines. The revolt of a Persian impostor employed at that moment the arms of the Saracen, and he could only intercede in favor of a place for which he felt and acknowledged some degree of filial affection. These solicitations determined the emperor to wound his pride in so sensible a part. Sosopetra was leveled with the ground. The Syrian prisoners were marked or mutilated with ignominious cruelty, and 1,000 female captives were forced away from the adjacent territory. Among these, a matron of the house of Abbas invoked in an agony of despair the name of Mutasim. and the insults of the Greeks engaged the honour of her kinsman to avenge his indignity and to answer her appeal. Under the reign of the two elder brothers, the inheritance of the youngest had been confined to Anatolia, Armenia, Georgia, and Circassia. This frontier station had exercised his military talents, and among his accidental claims to the name of Octonary. The most meritorious are the 8 battles which he gained or fought against the enemies of the Quran. In this personal quarrel, the troops of Iraq, Syria, and Egypt were recruited from the tribes of Arabia and the Turkish hordes. His cavalry might be numerous, though we should deduct some myriads from the 130,000 horses of the royal stables, and the expense of the armament was computed at 4 million sterling, or 100,000 pounds of gold. From Tarsus, the place of assembly, the Saracens advanced in 3 divisions along the high road of Constantinople. Motassem himself commanded the centre, and the vanguard was given to his son Abbas, who, in the trial of the first adventures, might succeed with the more glory or fail with the least reproach. In the revenge of his injury, the caliph prepared to retaliate a similar affront. The father of Theophilus was a native of Amorium in Phrygia. The original seat of the imperial house had been adorned with privileges and monuments. And, whatever might be the indifference of the people, Constantinople itself was scarcely of more value in the eyes of the sovereign and his court. The name of Amorium was inscribed on the shields of the Saracens, and their 3 armies were again united under the walls of the devoted city. It had been proposed by the wisest counsellors to evacuate Amorium, to remove the inhabitants and to abandon the empty structures to the vain resentment of the barbarians. The emperor embraced the more generous resolution of defending, in a siege and battle, the country of his ancestors. When the armies drew near, the front of the Mohammedan line appeared to a Roman eye more closely planted with spears and javelins, but the event of the action was not glorious on either side to the national troops. The Arabs were broken, but it was by the swords of 30,000 Persians who had obtained service and settlement in the Byzantine Empire. The Greeks were repulsed and vanquished, but it was by the arrows of the Turkish cavalry, and had not their bowstrings been damped and relaxed by the evening rain, very few of the Christians could have escaped with the emperor from the field of battle. They breathed at Dorylaeum at the distance of 3 days, and Theophilus, reviewing his trembling squadrons, forgave the common flight both of the prince and people. After this discovery of his weakness, he vainly hoped to deprecate the fate of Amorium. The inexorable caliph rejected with contempt his prayers and promises, and detained the Roman ambassadors to be the witnesses of his great revenge. They had nearly been the witnesses of his shame. The vigorous assaults of 55 days were encountered by a faithful governor, a veteran garrison, and a desperate people, and the Saracens must have raised the siege if a domestic traitor had not pointed to the weakest part of the wall, a place which was decorated with the statues of a lion and a bull. The vow of Motassem was accomplished with unrelenting rigor. Tired, rather than satiated with destruction, he returned to his new palace of Samara in the neighborhood of Baghdad, while the unfortunate Theophilus implored the tardy and doubtful aid of his western rival, the Emperor of the Franks. Yet in the siege of Amorium, about 70,000 Muslims had perished. Their loss had been revenged by the slaughter of 30,000 Christians and the sufferings of an equal number of captives, who were treated as the most atrocious criminals. Mutual necessity could sometimes extort the exchange or ransom of prisoners, but in the national and religious conflict of the two empires, peace was without confidence, and war without mercy. Quarter was seldom given in the field. Those who escaped the edge of the sword were condemned to hopeless servitude, or exquisite torture. And a Catholic emperor relates with visible satisfaction the execution of the Saracens of Crete, who were flayed alive, or plunged into cauldrons of boiling oil. To a point of honor, Mutasem had sacrificed a flourishing city, 200,000 lives, and the property of millions. The same caliph descended from his horse and dirtied his robe to relieve the distress of a decrepit old man who, with his laden ass, had tumbled into a ditch. On which of these actions did he reflect with the most pleasure when he was summoned by the angel of death? With Mutasim, the eighth of the Abbasides, the glory of his family and nation expired. When the Arabian conquerors had spread themselves over the east and were mingled with the servile crowds of Persia, Syria, and Egypt, they insensibly lost the freeborn and martial virtues of the desert. The courage of the south is the artificial fruit of discipline and prejudice. The active power of enthusiasm had decayed, and the mercenary forces of the caliphs were recruited in those climates of the north of which valor is the hardy and spontaneous production. Of the Turks who dwelt beyond the Oxus and Jaxartes, the robust youths, either taken in war or purchased in trade, were educated in the exercises of the field and the profession of the Mohammedan faith. The Turkish guards stood in arms round the throne of their benefactor, and their chiefs usurped the dominion of the palace and the provinces. Mutasim, the first author of this dangerous example, introduced into the capital above 50,000 Turks. Their licentious conduct provoked the public indignation, and the quarrels of the soldiers and people induced the caliph to retire from Baghdad and establish his own residence and the camp of his barbarian favorites at Samarra on the Tigris, about 12 leagues above the City of Peace. His son, Modar Wakel, was a jealous and cruel tyrant. Odious to his subjects, he cast himself on the fidelity of the strangers, and these strangers, ambitious and apprehensive, were tempted by the rich promise of a revolution. At the instigation, or at least in the cause of his son, they burst into his apartment at the hour of supper, and the caliph was cut into 7 pieces by the same swords which he had recently distributed among the guards of his life and throne. To this throne, yet streaming with a father's blood, Montasser was triumphantly led, but in a reign of 6 months he found only the pangs of a guilty conscience. If he wept at the sight of an old tapestry which represented the crime and punishment of the son of Chosroes, if his days were abridged by grief and remorse, we may allow some pity to a parricide, who exclaimed in the bitterness of death that he had lost both this world and the world to come. After this act of treason, the ensigns of royalty, the garment and walking staff of Mohammed, were given and torn away by the foreign mercenaries, who in 4 years created, deposed, and murdered 3 commanders of the faithful. As often as the Turks were inflamed by fear or rage or avarice, these caliphs were dragged by the feet, exposed naked to the scorching sun, beaten with iron clubs, and compelled to purchase, by the abdication of their dignity, a short reprieve of inevitable fate. At length, however, the fury of the tempest was spent or diverted. The Abbasides returned to the less turbulent residence of Baghdad. The insolence of the Turks was curbed with a firmer and more skillful hand, and their numbers were divided and destroyed in foreign warfare. But the nations of the East had been taught to trample on the successors of the Prophet, and the blessings of domestic peace were obtained by the relaxation of strength and discipline. So uniform are the mischiefs of military despotism that I seem to repeat the story of the Praetorians of Rome. Pause. Continue. While the flame of enthusiasm was damped by the business, the pleasure, and the knowledge of the age, it burnt with concentrated heat in the breasts of the chosen few, the congenial spirits who were ambitious of reigning either in this world or in the next. How carefully soever the book of prophecy had been sealed by the apostle of Mecca, the wishes, and if we may profane the word, even the reason of fanaticism might believe that after the successive missions of Adam, Noah, Abraham, Moses, Jesus, and Mohammed, the same God in the fullness of time would reveal a still more perfect and permanent law. In the 277th year of the Hegira, and in the neighborhood of Kufa, an Arabian preacher of the name of Kamath assumed the lofty and incomprehensible style of the guide, the director, the demonstration, the word, the Holy Ghost, the camel, the herald of the Messiah, who had conversed with him in a human shape, and the representative of Muhammad, the son of Ali, of St. John the Baptist, and of the angel Gabriel. In his mystic volume, the precepts of the Quran were refined to a more spiritual sense. He relaxed the duties of ablution, fasting, and pilgrimage, allowed the indiscriminate use of wine and forbidden food, and nourished the fervor of his disciples by the daily repetition of 50 prayers. The idleness and ferment of the rustic crowd awakened the attention of the magistrates of Kufa. A timid persecution assisted the progress of the new sect, and the name of the prophet became more revered after his person had been withdrawn from the world. His 12 apostles dispersed themselves among the Bedouins, a race of men, says Abulfeda, equally devoid of reason and of religion, and the success of their preaching seemed to threaten Arabia with a new revolution. The Carmathians were ripe for rebellion, since they disclaimed the title of the House of Abbas, and abhorred the worldly pomp of the caliphs of Baghdad. They were susceptible of discipline, since they vowed a blind and absolute submission to their imam, who was called to the prophetic office by the voice of God and the people. Instead of the legal tithes, he claimed the fifth of their substance and spoil. The most flagitious sins were no more than the type of disobedience, and the brethren were united and concealed by an oath of secrecy. After a bloody conflict, they prevailed in the province of Bahrain along the Persian Gulf. Far and wide the tribes of the desert were subject to the scepter, or rather to the sword, of Abu Sa'id and his son Abu Tahir. And these rebellious imams could muster in the field 107,000 fanatics. The mercenaries of the caliph were dismayed at the approach of an enemy who neither asked nor accepted quarter, and the difference between them in fortitude and patience is expressive of the change which 3 centuries of prosperity had effected in the character of the Arabians. Such troops were discomfited in every action. The cities of Raqqa and Baalbek, of Kufa and Bassora, were taken and pillaged. Baghdad was filled with consternation, and the caliph trembled behind the veils of his palace. In a daring inroad beyond the Tigris, Abu Tahir advanced to the gates of the capital with no more than 500 horse. By the special order of Muqtadir, the bridges had been broken down, and the person or head of the rebel was expected every hour by the commander of the faithful. His lieutenant, from a motive of fear or pity, apprised Abu Tahir of his danger and recommended a speedy escape. "Your master," said the intrepid Carmathian to the messenger, "is at the head of 30,000 soldiers. 3 such men as these are wanting in his host." At the same instant, turning to 3 of his companions, he commanded the first to plunge a dagger into his breast, the second to leap into the Tigris, and the third to cast himself headlong down a precipice. They obeyed without a murmur. Relate, continued the Imam, what you have seen. Before the evening your general shall be chained among my dogs. Before the evening the camp was surprised, and the menace was executed. The rapine of the Carnathians was sanctified by their aversion to the worship of Mecca. They robbed a caravan of pilgrims, and 20,000 devout Muslims were abandoned on the burning sands to a death of hunger and thirst. Another year they suffered the pilgrims to proceed without interruption. But in the festival of devotion, Abu Tahir stormed the holy city and trampled on the most venerable relics of the Mohammedan faith. 30,000 citizens and strangers were put to the sword. The sacred precincts were polluted by the burial of 3,000 dead bodies. The well of Zemzem overflowed with blood. The golden spout was forced from its place. The veil of the Kaaba was divided among these impious sectaries. And the Black Stone, the first monument of the nation, was borne away in triumph to their capital. After this deed of sacrilege and cruelty, they continued to infest the confines of Iraq, Syria, and Egypt. But the vital principle of enthusiasm had withered at the root. Their scruples, or their avarice, again opened the pilgrimage of Mecca and restored the black stone of the Kaaba. And it is needless to inquire into what factions they were broken or by whose swords they were finally extirpated. The sect of the Carnathians may be considered as the second visible cause of the decline and fall of the empire of the caliphs. The third and most obvious cause was the weight and magnitude of the empire itself. The Caliph al-Ma'mun might proudly assert that it was easier for him to rule the east and the west than to manage a chessboard of 2 feet square. Yet I suspect that in both these games he was guilty of many fatal mistakes. And I perceive that in the distant provinces the authority of the first and most powerful of the Abbasides was already impaired. The analogy of despotism invests the representative with the full majesty of the prince. The division and balance of powers might relax the habits of obedience, might encourage the passive subject to inquire into the origin and administration of civil government. He who is born in the purple is seldom worthy to reign. But the elevation of a private man, of a peasant, perhaps, or a slave, affords a strong presumption of his courage and capacity. The viceroy of a remote kingdom aspires to secure the property and inheritance of his precarious trust. The nations must rejoice in the presence of their sovereign, and the command of armies and treasures are at once the object and the instrument of his ambition. A change was scarcely visible as long as the lieutenants of the caliph were content with their vicarious title. While they solicited for themselves or their sons a renewal of the imperial grant, and still maintained on the coin and in the public prayers the name and prerogative of the commander of the faithful. But in the long and hereditary exercise of power, they assumed the pride and attributes of royalty. The alternative of peace or war, of reward or punishment, depended solely on their will, and the revenues of their government were reserved for local services or private magnificence. Instead of a regular supply of men and money, the successors of the prophet were flattered with the ostentatious gift of an elephant, or a cast of hawks, a suit of silk hangings, or some pounds of musk and amber. After the revolt of Spain from the temporal and spiritual supremacy of the Abbasides, the first symptoms of disobedience broke forth in the province of Africa. Ibrahim, the son of Aglab, the lieutenant of the vigilant and rigid Harun, bequeathed to the dynasty of the Aglabites the inheritance of his name and power. The indolence or policy of the caliphs dissembled the injury and loss and pursued only with poison the founder of the Idrisites, who erected the kingdom and city of Fez, on the shores of the Western Ocean. In the East, the first dynasty was that of the Taherites, the posterity of the valiant Taher, who, in the civil wars of the sons of Harun, had served with too much zeal and success the cause of Al-Mamun, the younger brother. He was sent into honorable exile to command on the banks of the Oxus, and the independence of his successors, who reigned in Khorasan till the fourth generation, was palliated by their modest and respectful demeanor, the happiness of their subjects, and the security of their frontier. They were supplanted by one of those adventurers so frequent in the annals of the East, who left his trade of a brazier, from whence the name of Sopharides, for the profession of a robber. In a nocturnal visit to the treasure of the prince of Sistan, Jacob, the son of Leif, stumbled over a lump of salt, which he unwarily tasted with his tongue. Salt, among the Orientals, is the symbol of hospitality, and the pious robber immediately retired without spoil or damage. The discovery of this honorable behavior recommended Jacob to pardon and trust. He led an army at first for his benefactor, at last for himself, subdued Persia, and threatened the residence of the Abbasides. On his march towards Baghdad, the conqueror was arrested by a fever. He gave audience in bed to the ambassador of the caliph, and beside him on a table were exposed a naked scimitar, a crust of brown bread, and a bunch of onions. "If I die," said he, "your master is delivered from his fears. If I live, this must determine between us. If I am vanquished, I can return without reluctance to the homely fare of my youth." From the height where he stood, the descent would not have been so soft or harmless. A timely death secured his own repose and that of the caliph, who paid with the most lavish concessions the retreat of his brother Amru to the palaces of Shiraz and Isfahan. The Abbasides were too feeble to contend, too proud to forgive. They invited the powerful dynasty of the Samanides, who passed the Oxus with 10,000 horse, so poor that their stirrups were of wood, so brave that they vanquished the Sopharian army, 8 times more numerous than their own. The captive Amru was sent in chains, a grateful offering to the court of Baghdad, and as the victor was content with the inheritance of Transoxiana and Khorasan, the realms of Persia returned for a while to the allegiance of the caliphs. The provinces of Syria and Egypt were twice dismembered by their Turkish slaves of the race of Toulon and Ilkshid. These barbarians, in religion and manners, the countrymen of Muhammad, emerged from the bloody factions of the palace to a provincial command and an independent throne. Their names became famous and formidable in their time, but the founders of these two potent dynasties confessed, either in words or actions, the vanity of ambition. The first on his deathbed implored the mercy of God to a sinner, ignorant of the limits of his own power. The second, in the midst of 400,000 soldiers and 8,000 slaves, concealed from every human eye the chamber where he attempted to sleep. Their sons were educated in the vices of kings, and both Egypt and Syria were recovered and possessed by the Abbasides during an interval of 30 years. In the decline of their empire, Mesopotamia, with the important cities of Mosul and Aleppo, was occupied by the Arabian princes of the tribe of Hamadan. The poets of their court could repeat without a blush that nature had formed their countenances for beauty, their tongues for eloquence, and their hands for liberality and valor. But the genuine tale of the elevation and reign of the Hamadanites exhibits a scene of treachery, murder, and parricide. At the same fatal period, the Persian kingdom was again usurped by the dynasty of the Bawides, by the sword of three brothers, who under various names were styled the support and columns of the state, and who from the Caspian Sea to the ocean would suffer no tyrants but themselves. Under their reign the language and genius of Persia revived, and the Arabs, 304 years after the death of Muhammad, were deprived of the scepter of the East. Rahadi, the 20th of the Abbasides, and the 39th of the successors of Muhammad, was the last who deserved the title of Commander of the Faithful. The last, says Abul Feda, who spoke to the people or conversed with the learned, the last who, in the expense of his household, represented the wealth and magnificence of the ancient caliphs. After him, the lords of the eastern world were reduced to the most abject misery and exposed to the blows and insults of a servile condition. The revolt of the provinces circumscribed their dominions within the walls of Baghdad, but that capital still contained an innumerable multitude vain of their past fortune, discontented with their present state, and oppressed by the demands of a treasury which had formerly been replenished by the spoil and tribute of nations. Their idleness was exercised by faction and controversy. Under the mask of piety, the rigid followers of Hanbal invaded the pleasures of domestic life, burst into the houses of plebeians and princes, poured out the wine, broke the instruments, beat the musicians, and dishonored, with infamous suspicions, the associates of every handsome youth. In each profession which allowed room for two persons, the one was a votary, the other an antagonist of Ali, and the Abbasides were awakened by the clamorous grief of the sectaries who denied their title and cursed their progenitors. A turbulent people could only be repressed by military force, but who could satisfy the avarice or assert the discipline of the mercenaries themselves? The African and the Turkish guards drew their swords against each other, and the chief commanders, the emirs al-Umra, imprisoned or deposed their sovereigns and violated the sanctuary of the mosque and harem. If the caliphs escaped to the camp or court of any neighboring prince, their deliverance was a change of servitude, till they were prompted by despair to invite the Bawidis, the sultans of Persia, who silenced the factions of Baghdad by their irresistible arms. The civil and military powers were assumed by Mosul Dawlat, the second of the three brothers, and a stipend of £60,000 sterling was assigned by his generosity for the private expense of the Commander of the Faithful. But on the 40th day, at the audience of the ambassadors of Khorasan, and in the presence of a trembling multitude, the caliph was dragged from his throne to a dungeon by the command of the stranger and the rude hands of his Dilamites. His palace was pillaged, his eyes were put out, and the mean ambition of the Abbasides aspired to the vacant station of danger and disgrace. In the school of adversity, the luxurious caliphs resumed the grave and abstemious virtues of the primitive times. Despoiled of their armor and silken robes, they fasted, they prayed, they studied the Koran and the tradition of the Sunnites. They performed with zeal and knowledge the functions of their ecclesiastical character. The respect of nations still waited on the successors of the apostle, the oracles of the law and conscience of the faithful. And the weakness or division of their tyrants sometimes restored the Abbasides to the sovereignty of Baghdad. But their misfortunes had been embittered by the triumph of the Fatimites, the real or spurious progeny of Ali. Arising from the extremity of Africa, these successful rivals extinguished in Egypt and Syria both the spiritual and temporal authority of the Abbasides, and the monarch of the Nile insulted the humble pontiff on the banks of the Tigris. In the declining age of the caliphs, in the century which elapsed after the war of Theophilus and Mutasim, the hostile transactions of the two nations were confined to some inroads by sea and land, the fruits of their close vicinity and indelible hatred. But when the eastern world was convulsed and broken, the Greeks were roused from their lethargy by the hopes of conquest and revenge. The Byzantine Empire, once the accession of the Basilian race, had reposed in peace and dignity, and they might encounter with their entire strength the front of some petty emir whose rear was assaulted and threatened by his national foes of the Mohammedan faith. The lofty titles of the Morning Star and the Death of the Saracens were applied in the public acclamations to Nicephorus Phocas, a prince as renowned in the camp as he was unpopular in the city. In the subordinate station of great domestic or general of the East, he reduced the island of Crete and extirpated the nest of pirates who had so long defied with impunity the majesty of the empire. His military genius was displayed in the conduct and success of the enterprise, which had so often failed with loss and dishonor. The Saracens were confounded by the landing of his troops on safe and level bridges, which he cast from the vessels to the shore. 7 months were consumed in the siege of Candia. The despair of the native Cretans was stimulated by the frequent aid of their brethren of Africa and Spain. And after the massy wall and double ditch had been stormed by the Greeks, a hopeless conflict was still maintained in the streets and houses of the city. The whole island was subdued in the capital, and a submissive people accepted, without resistance, the baptism of the conqueror. Constantinople applauded the long-forgotten pomp of a triumph, but the imperial diadem was the sole reward that could repay the services or satisfy the ambition of Nicephorus. After the death of the younger Romanus, the fourth in lineal descent of the Basilian race, his widow, Theophania, successively married Nicephorus Phocas and his assassin, John Zimisces, the two heroes of the age. They reigned as the guardians and colleagues of their infant sons, and the 12 years of their military command form the most splendid period of the Byzantine annals. The subjects and confederates whom they led to war appeared, at least in the eyes of an enemy, 200,000 strong, and of these about 30,000 were armed with cuirasses. A train of 4,000 mules attended their march, and their evening camp was regularly fortified with an enclosure of iron spikes. A series of bloody and undecisive combats is nothing more than an anticipation of what would have been effected in a few years by the course of nature. But I shall briefly prosecute the conquests of the two emperors from the hills of Cappadocia to the desert of Baghdad. The sieges of Mopsuestia and Tarsus in Cilicia first exercised the skill and perseverance of their troops, on whom at this moment I shall not hesitate to bestow the name of Romans. In the double city of Mopsuestia, which is divided by the river Sarus, 200,000 Muslims were predestined to death or slavery, a surprising degree of population, which must at least include the inhabitants of the dependent districts. They were surrounded and taken by assault, but Tarsus was reduced by the slow progress of famine, and no sooner had the Saracens yielded on honorable terms than they were mortified by the distant and unprofitable view of the naval succors of Egypt. They were dismissed with a safe conduct to the confines of Syria. A part of the old Christians had quietly lived under their dominion, and the vacant habitations were replenished by a new colony. But the mosque was converted into a stable. The pulpit was delivered to the flames. Many rich crosses of gold and gems, the spoils of Asiatic churches, were made a grateful offering to the piety or avarice of the emperor, and he transported the gates of Mopsuestia and Tarsus, which were fixed in the walls of Constantinople, an eternal monument of his victory. After they had forced and secured the narrow passes of Mount Amanus, the two Roman princes repeatedly carried their arms into the heart of Syria. Yet instead of assaulting the walls of Antioch, the humanity or superstition of Nicephorus appeared to respect the ancient metropolis of the East. He contented himself with drawing round the city a line of circumvallation, left a stationary army, and instructed his lieutenant to expect without impatience the return of spring. But in the depth of winter, in a dark and rainy night, an adventurous subaltern with 300 soldiers approached the rampart, applied his scaling ladders, occupied two adjacent towers, stood firm against the pressure of multitudes, and bravely maintained his post till he was relieved by the tardy, though effectual, support of his reluctant chief. The first tumult of slaughter and rapine subsided. The reign of Caesar and of Christ was restored, and the efforts of 100,000 Saracens, of the armies of Syria and the fleets of Africa, were consumed without effect before the walls of Antioch. The royal city of Aleppo was subject to Saifed Daulat, of the dynasty of Hamadan, who clouded his past glory by the precipitate retreat which abandoned his kingdom and capital to the Roman invaders. In his stately palace that stood without the walls of Aleppo, they joyfully seized a well-furnished magazine of arms, a stable of 1,400 mules, and 300 bags of silver and gold. But the walls of the city withstood the strokes of their battering rams, and the besiegers pitched their tents on the neighboring mountain of Jashan. Their retreat exasperated the quarrel of the townsmen and mercenaries. The guard of the gates and ramparts was deserted, and while they furiously charged each other in the marketplace, they were surprised and destroyed by the sword of a common enemy. The male sex was exterminated by the sword. 10,000 youths were led into captivity. The weight of the precious spoil exceeded the strength and number of the beasts of burden. The superfluous remainder was burnt, and after a licentious possession of 10 days, the Romans marched away from the naked and bleeding city. In their Syrian inroads, they commanded the husbandmen to cultivate their lands, that they themselves in the ensuing season might reap the benefit. More than 100 cities were reduced to obedience, and 18 pulpits of the principal mosques were committed to the flames to expiate the sacrilege of the disciples of Muhammad. The classic names of Hierapolis, Apamea, and Emesa revive for a moment in the list of conquest. The Emperor Zimisces encamped in the paradise of Damascus, and accepted the ransom of a submissive people, and the torrent was only stopped by the impregnable fortress of Tripoli on the seacoast of Phoenicia. Since the days of Heraclius, the Euphrates, below the passage of Mount Taurus, had been impervious and almost invisible to the Greeks. The river yielded a free passage to the victorious Zimisces, and the historian may imitate the speed with which he overran the once famous cities of Samosata, Edessa, Martyropolis, Amida, and Nisibis, the ancient limit of the empire in the neighborhood of the Tigris. His ardor was quickened by the desire of grasping the virgin treasures of Ecbatana, a well-known name under which the Byzantine writer has concealed the capital of the Abbasides. The consternation of the fugitives had already diffused the terror of his name, but the fancied riches of Baghdad had already been dissipated by the avarice and prodigality of domestic tyrants. The prayers of the people and the stern demands of the lieutenant of the Bawides required the caliph to provide for the defense of the city. The helpless Mothi replied that his arms, his revenues, and his provinces had been torn from his hands, and that he was ready to abdicate a dignity which he was unable to support. The emir was inexorable. The furniture of the palace was sold, and the paltry price of 40,000 pieces of gold was instantly consumed in private luxury. But the apprehensions of Baghdad were relieved by the retreat of the Greeks. Thirst and hunger guarded the desert of Mesopotamia, and the emperor, satiated with glory and laden with oriental spoils, returned to Constantinople and displayed in his triumph the silk, the aromatics, and 300 myriads of gold and silver. Yet the powers of the East had been bent, not broken by this transient hurricane. After the departure of the Greeks, the fugitive princes returned to their capitals. The subjects disclaimed their involuntary oaths of allegiance. The Muslims again purified their temples and overturned the idols of the saints and martyrs. The Nestorians and Jacobites preferred a Saracen to an Orthodox master, and the numbers and spirit of the Melkites were inadequate to the support of the church and state. Of these extensive conquests, Antioch, with the cities of Cilicia and the Isle of Cyprus, was alone restored, a permanent and useful accession to the Roman Empire. Chapter 53. State of the Eastern Empire in the 10th century. Extent and division. Wealth and revenue. Palace of Constantinople. Titles and offices. Pride and power of the emperors. Tactics of the Greeks, Arabs, and Franks. Loss of the Latin tongue. Studies and solitude of the Greeks. A ray of historic light seems to beam from the darkness of the 10th century. We open with curiosity and respect the royal volumes of Constantine Porphyrogenitus, which he composed at a mature age for the instruction of his son, and which promised to unfold the state of the Eastern Empire, both in peace and war, both at home and abroad. In the first of these works he minutely describes the pompous ceremonies of the church and palace of Constantinople, according to his own practice and that of his predecessors. In the second, he attempts an accurate survey of the provinces, the themes as they were then denominated, both of Europe and Asia. The system of Roman tactics, the discipline and order of the troops, and the military operations by land and sea are explained in the third of these didactic collections, which may be ascribed to Constantine or his father Leo. In the fourth of the administration of the empire, he reveals the secrets of the Byzantine policy in friendly or hostile intercourse with the nations of the earth. The literary labors of the age, the practical systems of law, agriculture, and history might redound to the benefit of the subject and the honor of the Macedonian princes. The 60 books of the Basilics, the Code and Pandects of civil jurisprudence, were gradually framed in the three first reigns of that prosperous dynasty. The art of agriculture had amused the leisure and exercised the pens of the best and wisest of the ancients, and their chosen precepts are comprised in the 20 books of the Geoponics of Constantine. At his command, the historical examples of vice and virtue were methodized in 53 books, and every citizen might apply to his contemporaries or himself the lesson or the warning of past times. From the august character of a legislator, the sovereign of the East descends to the more humble office of a teacher and a scribe, and if his successors and subjects were regardless of his paternal cares, we may inherit and enjoy the everlasting legacy. A closer survey will indeed reduce the value of the gift and the gratitude of posterity. In the possession of these imperial treasures we may still deplore our poverty and ignorance, and the fading glories of their authors will be obliterated by indifference or contempt. The basilics will sink to a broken copy, a partial and mutilated version in the Greek language of the laws of Justinian. But the sense of the old civilians is often superseded by the influence of bigotry, and the absolute prohibition of divorce, concubinage, and interest for money enslaves the freedom of trade and the happiness of private life. In the historical book, a subject of Constantine might admire the inimitable virtues of Greece and Rome. He might learn to what a pitch of energy and elevation the human character had formerly aspired. But a contrary effect must have been produced by a new edition of the Lives of the Saints, which the great logothete, or chancellor of the empire, was directed to prepare. And the dark fund of superstition was enriched by the fabulous and florid legends of Simon the Metaphrast. The merits and miracles of the whole calendar are of less account in the eyes of a sage than the toil of a single husbandman who multiplies the gifts of the Creator and supplies the food of his brethren. Yet the royal authors of the Geoponics were more seriously employed in expounding the precepts of the destroying art, which had been taught since the days of Xenophon, as the art of heroes and kings. But the tactics of Leo and Constantine are mingled with the baser alloy of the age in which they lived. It was destitute of original genius. They implicitly transcribed the rules and maxims which had been confirmed by victories. It was unskilled in the propriety of style and method. They blindly confound the most distant and discordant institutions, the phalanx of Sparta and that of Macedon, the legions of Cato and Trajan, of Augustus and Theodosius. Even the use, or at least the importance, of these military rudiments may be fairly questioned. Their general theory is dictated by reason, but the merit, as well as difficulty, consists in the application. The discipline of a soldier is formed by exercise rather than by study. The talents of a commander are appropriated to those calm, though rapid, minds which nature produces to decide the fate of armies and nations. The former is the habit of a life, the latter the glance of a moment, and the battles won by lessons of tactics may be numbered with the epic poems created from the rules of criticism. The Book of Ceremonies is a recital, tedious yet imperfect, of the despicable pageantry which had infected the church and state since the gradual decay of the purity of the one and the power of the other. A review of the themes or provinces might promise such authentic and useful information as the curiosity of government only can obtain, instead of traditionary fables on the origin of the cities and malicious epigrams on the vices of their inhabitants. Such information the historian would have been pleased to record. Nor should his silence be condemned if the most interesting objects, the population of the capital and provinces, the amount of the taxes and revenues, the numbers of subjects and strangers who served under the imperial standard, have been unnoticed by Leo the philosopher and his son Constantine. His treatise of the public administration is stained with the same blemishes, yet it is discriminated by peculiar merit. The antiquities of the nations may be doubtful or fabulous, but the geography and manners of the barbaric world are delineated with curious accuracy. Of these nations, the Franks alone were qualified to observe in their turn and to describe the metropolis of the East. The ambassador of the great Otho, a bishop of Cremona, has painted the state of Constantinople about the middle of the 10th century. His style is glowing, his narrative lively, his observation keen, and even the prejudices and passions of Liutprand are stamped with an original character of freedom and genius. From this scanty fund of foreign and domestic materials, I shall investigate the form and substance of the Byzantine Empire, the provinces and wealth, the civil government and military force, the character and literature of the Greeks in a period of 600 years from the reign of Heraclius to his successful invasion of the Franks or Latins. After the final division between the sons of Theodosius, the swarms of barbarians from Scythia and Germany overspread the provinces and extinguished the empire of ancient Rome. The weakness of Constantinople was concealed by extent of dominion. Her limits were inviolate, or at least entire, and the kingdom of Justinian was enlarged by the splendid acquisition of Africa and Italy. But the possession of these new conquests was transient and precarious, and almost a moiety of the Eastern Empire was torn away by the arms of the Saracens. Syria and Egypt were oppressed by the Arabian caliphs, and after the reduction of Africa, their lieutenants invaded and subdued the Roman province which had been changed into the Gothic monarchy of Spain. The islands of the Mediterranean were not inaccessible to their naval powers, and it was from their extreme stations, the harbors of Crete and the fortresses of Cilicia, that the faithful or rebel emirs insulted the majesty of the throne and capital. The remaining provinces, under the obedience of the emperors, were cast into a new mold, and the jurisdiction of the presidents, the consulars, and the counts were superseded by the institution of the themes, or military governments, which prevailed under the successors of Heraclius, and are described by the pen of the royal author. Of the 29 themes, 12 in Europe and 17 in Asia, the origin is obscure, the etymology doubtful or capricious. The limits were arbitrary and fluctuating, but some particular names that sound the most strangely to our ear were derived from the character and attributes of the troops that were maintained at the expense and for the guard of the respective divisions. The vanity of the Greek princes most eagerly grasped the shadow of conquest and the memory of lost dominion. A new Mesopotamia was created on the western side of the Euphrates. The appellation and praetor of Sicily were transferred to a narrow slip of Calabria, and a fragment of the Duchy of Beneventum was promoted to the style and title of the theme of Lombardy. In the decline of the Arabian Empire, the successors of Constantine might indulge their pride in more solid advantages. The victories of Nicephorus, John Zimisces, and Basil II revived the fame and enlarged the boundaries of the Roman name. The province of Cilicia, the metropolis of Antioch, the islands of Crete and Cyprus were restored to the allegiance of Christ and Caesar. One-third of Italy was annexed to the throne of Constantinople. The kingdom of Bulgaria was destroyed, and the last sovereigns of the Macedonian dynasty extended their sway from the sources of the Tigris to the neighborhood of Rome. In the 11th century, the prospect was again clouded by new enemies and new misfortunes. The relics of Italy were swept away by the Norman adventures, and almost all the Asiatic branches were dissevered from the Roman trunk by the Turkish conquerors. After these losses, the emperors of the Comnenian family continued to reign from the Danube to Peloponnesus, and from Belgrade to Nice, Trebizond, and the winding stream of the Meander. The spacious provinces of Thrace, Macedonia, and Greece were obedient to their scepter. The possession of Cyprus, Rhodes, and Crete was accompanied by the 50 islands of the Aegean, or Holy Sea, and the remnant of their empire transcends the measure of the largest of the European kingdoms. The same princes might assert with dignity and truth that of all the monarchs of Christendom they possessed the greatest city, the most ample revenue, the most flourishing and populous state. With the decline and fall of the empire, the cities of the West had decayed and fallen, Nor could the ruins of Rome, or the mud walls, wooden hovels, and narrow precincts of Paris and London prepare the Latin stranger to contemplate the situation and extent of Constantinople, her stately palaces and churches, and the arts and luxury of an innumerable people. Her treasures might attract, but her virgin strength had repelled, and still promised to repel, the audacious invasion of the Persian and Bulgarian, the Arab and the Russian. The provinces were less fortunate and impregnable, and few districts, few cities could be discovered which had not been violated by some fierce barbarian impatient to despoil because he was hopeless to possess. From the age of Justinian, the Eastern Empire was sinking below its former level. The powers of destruction were more active than those of improvement, and the calamities of war were embittered by the more permanent evils of civil and ecclesiastical tyranny. The captive who had escaped from the barbarians was often stripped and imprisoned by the ministers of his sovereign. The Greek superstition relaxed the mind by prayer, and emaciated the body by fasting, and the multitude of convents and festivals diverted many hands and many days from the temporal service of mankind. Yet the subjects of the Byzantine Empire were still the most dexterous and diligent of nations. Their country was blessed by nature with every advantage of soil, climate, and situation. And in the support and restoration of the arts, their patient and peaceful temper was more useful than the warlike spirit and feudal anarchy of Europe. The provinces that still adhered to the empire were repeopled and enriched by the misfortunes of those which were irrecoverably lost. From the yoke of the caliphs, the Catholics of Syria, Egypt, and Africa retired to the allegiance of their prince, to the society of their brethren. The movable wealth, which eludes the search of oppression, accompanied and alleviated their exile, and Constantinople received into her bosom the fugitive trade of Alexandria and Tyre. The chiefs of Armenia and Scythia, who fled from hostile or religious persecution, were hospitably entertained. Their followers were encouraged to build new cities and to cultivate waste lands, and many spots, both in Europe and Asia, preserved the name, the manners, or at least the memory of these national colonies. Even the tribes of barbarians who had seated themselves in arms on the territory of the empire were gradually reclaimed to the laws of the church and state. And as long as they were separated from the Greeks, their posterity supplied a race of faithful and obedient soldiers. Did we possess sufficient materials to survey the 29 themes of the Byzantine monarchy, our curiosity might be satisfied with a chosen example. It is fortunate enough that the clearest light should be thrown on the most interesting province, and the name of Peloponnesus will awaken the attention of the classic reader. As early as the 8th century, in the troubled reign of the Iconoclasts, Greece and even Peloponnesus were overrun by some Sclavonian bands who outstripped the royal standard of Bulgaria. The strangers of old, Cadmus and Danaus and Pelops, had planted in that fruitful soil the seeds of policy and learning. But the savages of the north eradicated what yet remained of their sickly and withered roots. In this eruption, the country and the inhabitants were transformed. The Grecian blood was contaminated, and the proudest nobles of Peloponnesus were branded with the names of foreigners and slaves. By the diligence of succeeding princes, the land was in some measure purified from the barbarians, and the humble remnant was bound by an oath of obedience, tribute, and military service, which they often renewed and often violated. The siege of Patras was formed by a singular concurrence of the Sclavonians of Peloponnesus and the Saracens of Africa. In their last distress, a pious fiction of the approach of the praetor of Corinth revived the courage of the citizens. Their sally was bold and successful. The strangers embarked, the rebels submitted, and the glory of the day was ascribed to a phantom or a stranger who fought in the foremost ranks under the character of St. Andrew the Apostle. The shrine which contained his relics was decorated with the trophies of victory, and the captive race was forever devoted to the service and vassalage of the Metropolitan Church of Patras. By the revolt of two Sclavonian tribes in the neighbourhood of Helos and Lacedaemon, the peace of the peninsula was often disturbed. They sometimes insulted the weakness and sometimes resisted the oppression of the Byzantine government, till at length the approach of their hostile brethren extorted a golden bull to define the rights and obligations of the Ezraites and Melengi, whose annual tribute was defined at 1,200 pieces of gold. From these strangers the imperial geographer has accurately distinguished a domestic and perhaps original race who in some degree might derive their blood from the much-injured Helots. The liberality of the Romans, and especially of Augustus, had enfranchised the maritime cities from the dominion of Sparta, and the continuance of the same benefit ennobled them with the title of Eleutero, or Free Laconians. In the time of Constantine Porphyrogenitus, they had acquired the name of Minutes, under which they dishonour the claim of liberty by the inhuman pillage of all that is shipwrecked on their rocky shores. Their territory, barren of corn but fruitful of olives, extended to the Cape of Malea. They accepted a chief or prince from the Byzantine praetor, and a light tribute of 400 pieces of gold was the badge of their immunity rather than of their dependence. The freemen of Laconia assumed the character of Romans, and long adhered to the religion of the Greeks. By the zeal of the Emperor Basil, they were baptized in the faith of Christ. But the altars of Venus and Neptune had been crowned by these rustic votaries 500 years after they were prescribed in the Roman world. In the theme of Peloponnesus, 40 cities were still numbered, and the declining state of Sparta, Argos, and Corinth may be suspended in the 10th century at an equal distance, perhaps between their antique splendor and their present desolation. The duty of military service, either in person or by substitute, was imposed on the lands or benefices of the province. A sum of 5 pieces of gold was assessed on each of the substantial tenants, and the same capitation was shared among several heads of inferior value. On the proclamation of an Italian war, the Peloponnesians excused themselves by a voluntary oblation of 100 pounds of gold, 4,000 pounds sterling, and 1,000 horses with their arms and trappings. The churches and monasteries furnished their contingent. A sacrilegious profit was extorted from the sale of ecclesiastical honours, and the indigent bishop of Leucadia was made responsible for a pension of 100 pieces of gold. But the wealth of the province and the trust of the revenue were founded on the fair and plentiful produce of trade and manufacturers, and some symptoms of liberal policy may be traced in a law which exempts from all personal taxes the mariners of Peloponnesus and the workmen in parchment and purple. This denomination may be fairly applied or extended to the manufacturers of linen, woolen, and more especially of silk. The two former, of which had flourished in Greece since the days of Homer, and the last was introduced perhaps as early as the reign of Justinian. These arts, which were exercised at Corinth, Thebes, and Argos, afforded food and occupation to a numerous people. The men, women, and children were distributed according to their age and strength. And if many of these were domestic slaves, their masters, who directed the work and enjoyed the profit, were of a free and honorable condition. The gifts which a rich and generous matron of Peloponnesus presented to the Emperor Basil, her adopted son, were doubtless fabricated in the Grecian looms. Danielis